As a reminder, just big picture where we're at. David is at rock bottom at this point in terms of his journey. We're about to see things turn for him in a significant way. Obviously, now that Jonathan and Saul are dead, we see obviously what's coming around the corner, hence 2 Samuel. Okay? 1 Samuel is all about preparation for David, God taking him through this stripping process, if you will, to get him ready to lead. So if 1 Samuel is about preparation, what do you think 2 Samuel is about? We good? What's going on? Did she distract you? So this is going to be God establishing the kingdom with David. Okay, so we're going to see that this morning. All right, so let's pick up 2 Samuel, verse 1 of chapter 1. David is going to get news finally about Saul and Jonathan. All right, so let's pick up there. 2 Samuel 1:1. All right, so this guy's coming from Saul's camp. He's got news that David wants, and he knows that, okay? Now, this guy's dirty, okay? David says to him in verse 3, where are you from? He says, hey, I escaped from the camp of Israel, verse 3. So, like, I was in the battle, now I'm gonzo. Okay, verse 4, David said to him, tell me how things went. Okay, and here's his answer in verse 4. Evan, pick up there. Mafia man.
And David said to him, how did it go? Tell me.
All right, so he just got news. Saul the king and Jonathan, his best friend, are both dead. And he says, hey, how do you know this? Okay, tell me how you know this, verse 6. He says, by chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on a spear. And behold, the chariots and horsemen pursued him closely. When he looked behind him, he saw me and said, hey, come here. He said, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And he said, I am an Amalekite. Then he said to me, please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me because of my life still lingers in me. So I stood beside him and killed him because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. Now, we read a different version of the story earlier. How did Saul die? He killed himself. Now, this guy apparently watched that scene go down with Saul and his armor bearer, and his armor bearer said no. So Saul leaned on his sword and killed himself. Well, who's to be the wiser? Then they came and armor bearer died too, so nobody knows. There's three people that know the story. Two of them are dead. So he says to David, I killed him. Why would this guy be saying, by the way, I killed the former king? He thinks he's about to get something from David, right? He wants props. So he's thinking that's David's true intent. He wants Saul dead. I will be responsible. So not only does he tell this to David, he also says, hey, looky, looky what I got. I have the crown, verse 10, which was on his head, and his bracelet, which was on his arm. I've got proof. So I killed him and I stripped him. So this dirty guy watches Saul commit suicide, walks over there, rips the crown and his bracelet off his arm, and then runs back to David. So this guy's a chump, and he's about to get the reaction from David that you would expect. Now, before he deals with this guy, I want you to notice what David does. Okay, look at verse 11.
Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so also did all the men who were with him. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan, and for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword.
That's pretty impressive, right? They mourn, and this is not some external show of like, oh man, we should probably fake like we're sorry, right? He's legitimately torn up over this. Look at 17 and following. David chanted with lament over Saul and Jonathan. He basically, just in this moment, writes a psalm. If you look at 19 all the way through 27, this is David's poem of lament. This is a psalm of lament for these two, okay? And it's not just Jonathan, obviously, who we know he's greatly distressed about, but this is about Saul, and it's also about the glory of God being diminished to some degree because now they're going to tell in Philistia the stories of, oh, he killed the king, and now he's concerned even about God's reputation in the midst of that. So 19, Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ascalon. Obviously, these are Philistine streets. They're saying, he's saying, don't exalt these things. On the mountains of Gilboa, which is where they died, let not dew or rain on you fall on your fields or your offerings. So this is basically a song of anointing, or a psalm of lament. Verse 22, he mentions Jonathan. The bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty, meaning both were valiant, both were courageous. 23, Saul and Jonathan were beloved. Verse 24, O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet. So he commands the people to weep and be mournful about this. So you're seeing a pretty heartfelt response in David. Obviously, he feels probably a more significant loss of Jonathan, and he mentions that in verse 26 about how significant their relationship was. Brings up that concept of your love to me was more wonderful than that of women. Just the idea of, again, their partnership and their history that they have together. So he weeps, okay? However, back to this guy that brings this news. So they mourn and they write this song. But in verse 13, so chapter 1, verse 13, David's now going to turn his attention to this Amalekite, and he's going to speak to them. Okay, so someone pick up there in 13. Or 14, actually. All right, so that's been David's theology this whole time. Man, whoever does this, is they got something else coming. So 15, here's the reward that you get for killing Saul. So he was expecting like a big fat check with a lot of zeros, and he got executed on the spot. So again, you see that. Now, why would it be so important that David responds this way? I think it is genuinely heartfelt, but why is this important? Absolutely. So if he shows like zero remorse and is like, yeah, punk, right, then that's not good for his leadership. And you see a right heart in David. He mourns over Saul because he truly believes this. That was God's man. And God brought him down in a way that David would have preferred not even to be a part of. And he said, for that, you're going to die. There's no crown on your head. Okay, so now begins the reign of David. Okay, so Saul's been put down. His best friend is now dead. David realizes that, but he also realizes, God, you promised me this 20 plus years ago, the kingdom, and now it's finally coming to fruition. Okay, so chapter 2, verse 1, David comes to God and says, Lord, what do you want me to do? Do I go up to Judah, where the capital would have been at this time? Do I go up to Hebron in Judah and set up shop? Is this what you want me to do? And God says, go to Hebron. Okay, David went up there with his family, his two wives at the time. David brought up the men that were with him, verse 3, in his household, to the men of Judah. And there, in verse 4, anointed David king over the house of Judah. So David becomes king at this point of the southern half of the kingdom. Okay, you guys remember in the book of Judges, and we've seen a couple other places where that division is beginning to occur between Israel and Judah. Judah's the huge landmass in the south, and Benjamin is that little dot inside of Judah. There's a nice geographical barrier between the top of Judah and the rest of all the tribes in Israel, and that becomes kind of a division that David's going to have to fight, and Solomon will even more so in his kingdom. So Judah anoints him king. Okay, so now where is David from? What line? Tribe of?
Judah,
same as Jesus, okay? So good, right? So very natural that they would anoint him king, all right? So this is a little bit easier. Now, the rest of Israel is going to lag behind, okay? And we're going to see why here in verse 8, okay? So he gets anointed, and notice who else he takes care of. He gets word in verse 4 that the men of Jabesh-Gilead had honored Saul. You remember those guys that ran all night, took his body off the wall in Beth-Shean, took it back and buried him? David sends messengers to the men at Jabesh-Gilead. When David shows up at your door with the message saying, hey, I heard you honored Saul, what would your first response be? I'm the new king in town. I heard you were siding with Saul. You took his body down and buried him. What's your initial response? This may not end real well. Okay, watch what David does for these guys. Okay, verse 6 and 7.
Let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them.
So what do you see in David's heart, just at the very beginning of his kingdom? And he's handling things right, right? He's taking care of those people. He says, man, that's the you guys did the honorable thing, so we will take care of you, okay? So at the very beginning, takes care of the people that took care of Saul, all right? So keep that in mind. That's going to be David's kind of theme as he rules, right? Problem is verse 8, okay? We've got a issue with Abner, former commander of Saul's army, okay? This is what he does. Read verse 8.
Took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, and the Asherites and Jezreel, and Ephraim and Benjamin, and all Israel.
So Abner takes Saul's son, Ishbosheth. Remember him, the guy that was born, his name was Son of Shame, or from the mouth of shame? That's this kid, okay? He's Saul's son. And Abner basically takes him and says, you're the new king, okay? Ishbosheth, easy for me to say, he's a puppet, okay? And the guy that controls him is Abner, okay? So he is just some nobody, basically. This guy is not a competent ruler. But Abner puts him in a position of kingdom, or, of the king of the north. Why would Abner do that? What's Abner's angle? He wants power, okay? And he knows, I don't have the line to the throne, but Ishbosheth does as a rightful son of Saul. And Israel is having a lot harder time following David because he's only been anointed in the south. So he makes him king. So very smart political move on Abner's part if you want to become the king one day, which Abner does. Okay, so he's got political ambitions, and this guy's just a puppet for him to get there. Okay, so he makes him king over Israel, but he's still kind of basically... he's anointed himself as now Ishbosheth's right-hand man and his commander of his army. Okay, so in verse 12, we're going to see a war break out between the north and the south, between Joab and David and their armies, and Ishbosheth and Abner. Okay, interesting scene here. Pick up in verse 12. Let's watch how this unfolds.
Abner, the son of Ner, and the servant of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon, and they sat down, the one on the side of the pool and the other on the side of the pool.
All right, so you've got this scene where you've got two armies that are facing each other, okay? They're ready to go to battle. Instead of going to a full-on battle, Abner says to Joab, hey, now let the young man, verse 14, arise and hold a contest before us, okay? This is David and Goliath-esque, but a little bit different. Okay, so they arose, verse 15, went over by count, 12 from Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 from the servants of David. Okay, so 12 v 12, okay? And we're going to have a contest, and we're going to play a game of chicken, basically is what's going to happen, okay? They arose, went over by count, they stood in front of each other. Each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into his opponent's side. Okay, so here's the game of chicken. You take your left hand, you grab your opponent's head. With their left hand, they have their hand on your head. You take your right hand and put your sword in your opponent's side, okay? And you go, okay? And it's a game of chicken. Who's gonna walk away and say, I don't want any part of this, okay? That's what they do. So at the same time, they both stab each other, and 24 people die like that. Now, remember, who picks this fight? Verse 14. Whose idea is this? Abner. Okay, so Abner says to Joab, hey, got an idea. And Joab says, okay. So... No one caves in the game of chicken. 24 people die, okay? And it's a bad deal. So now that doesn't decide the battle, so now they start fighting, okay? Verse 17, the battle was very severe. Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So Joab says, you want some of this? Here you go. You lost the battle. You guys are defeated. Abner now takes off. And the three sons of Zeruiah, this is Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, those three brothers, they flee now after Abner, okay? Verse 17, Asahel pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or the left following Abner. Now, Asahel is the youngest of Joab's brothers, okay? So Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, okay? Asahel also is apparently a track star because he runs this guy down. He's really young, and now he's coming up against Abner, who's a very experienced, battle-hardened guy. And Abner basically says in verse 22, Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you down? How could I lift up my face to your brother? Meaning, bro, I'm going to give you an out, but you need to turn around. If I stop and we go to battle, it's going to end one way, which is you dead and you don't want any of this. So Abner gives him an out and says, bro, you're young, you're zealous, good for you. I will take you down in a heartbeat. You do not want to mess with Abner. Okay, and Abner's not being cocky, he's being honest. And he said, listen, you don't want any of this. Okay, so verse 23, Asahel will not stop running and pursuing him. So verse 23, he refused. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of his spear. Like, you're bad when you take the butt end of your spear and run a guy through, okay? He doesn't even use the sharp end, okay? And on the spot, end of verse 23, Asahel falls and dies and stood still. So, battle over, okay? So, Abner said, I told you this was coming. You didn't want to back down, and you got what was coming, and now you're dead, okay? Problem is verse 24, pick up there. How do you think Joab feels about this? No bueno, right? Keep going.
But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, and as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gia on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon.
So Joab, obviously, and Abishai, brother, want vengeance on Abner because they just watched their brother get murdered in cold blood by Abner, okay? Abner says to Joab in verse 26, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? Like, if we just keep going back and forth and killing one another, there's no end to this. I tried to give him an out. He didn't take it. I killed him. You know, he was threatening my life, so I took his. So Joab realizes, as much as I want to kill you right now, there's actually some wisdom in that statement because it's not going to end. And he says, man, basically, verse 27, as God lives, had you not spoken, surely the people would have gone away from in the morning, each following his own brother. Had you not picked this fight, Abner, none of this would have happened. You're the guy that came up with a 12-on-12 match. You're the guy that picked the fight. We're just finishing it. But Joab basically realizes, man, this is on you, but you're right. So Joab in verse 28 blows the trumpet and says, we're done. We're going to walk away. Verse 28, Abner and all his men went through the Arabah, south of the Dead Sea, that night, walked across the Jordan into Mahanaim. You guys remember Mahanaim? We've seen it a couple times. That's Jacob's land east of the Jordan that he came through. So Abner and his men head east, and they're basically fleeing, okay? Because they know they lost the battle, but Joab stops it there to say, listen, we're not going to have any more bloodshed. Knowing what you know about commanders of war, do you think Joab's just going to let this day go? Probably not, right? So Joab is a strong, relentless, he's a great leader. He doesn't take correction well, and he's got now a bone to pick with Abner, and it doesn't go away here. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, now, chapter 3, okay? David's house, 3 verse 1, is getting stronger, but Saul's house is getting weaker. So we got an issue, okay? David is continuing to gain favor through battles, through his heart. People are becoming more and more attracted to him in terms of his leadership, and Saul's house is becoming weak because Ishbosheth is not a king, he's a puppet, and Abner is not ultimately the guy to lead. And Abner is smart enough to figure this out, okay? So, he does something that's very interesting in verse 6 with Ishbosheth. Read 3 verse 6, and let's see what Abner's new plan is.
While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine, his name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, why have you gone into my father's concubine?
Now, we've seen the situation before. What does that mean when you take somebody's concubine and you go into them in the presence of everybody? What are you saying? It's a slap in the face, and what are you asking for? We saw Reuben do it to Jacob, right? I want the rights of the father. I'm the new guy in town. I am showing my manhood, right? I'm thumping my chest and I'm saying, I want you dead, and I'm the new guy in town. That's what Abner's doing, okay? So he's basically saying, Ishbosheth, you're a puppet, you're an idiot, I've controlled you from the beginning, we're just going to get rid of the puppet and I'm going to be the guy. And the way I'm going to get into your family is to take one of your dad's, Saul's, concubines, make her my own, and now guess what I get? The throne, okay? So that's his hope, maybe, okay? But that's what that would have at least said to Ishbosheth. This was not a good thing, right? This isn't going to keep them on friendly terms, okay? So Ishbosheth is smart enough to realize this is not good. Like, this is not a friendly, right? He isn't doing this to make friends with me. So verse 8, listen to Abner's response. It's an odd response. Today I have shown kindness to the house of Saul. It's like, really? Like, you just slept with this concubine in broad daylight in front of everybody and didn't deny it. Like, how is that kindness? But there's a piece of it where you're like, well, he's trying to keep Saul's house together. He's been faithful to Saul, but he sees which way the wind is blowing, and it's David's way. So he's like, man, this is not good. So whether he did this for the actual kingdom or he's trying to create an intentional rift between he and Ishbosheth, it's a fascinating play, okay? So he says in verse 9, may God do so to Abner and more, if as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and establish the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. So he says, fine, you don't like what I've done? Here's my new plan. I'm going to take the kingdom and I'm going to strip it away from you and I'm going to help establish David's kingdom. Like, man, that's a very bold claim. So whether or not Abner is being completely genuine in this, it's kind of hard to tell. I actually tend to believe him, and we're going to see how this plays out. But that's Abner's cry. He's like, great. Yep, I slept with your concubine. Now there's a rift that may have given an out for Abner to say, okay, that's done. Now I can pursue what God is doing, which is apparently behind David. And Abner's at least smart enough to see that. Now, he goes about it in an odd way, but that's the new cry, okay? So that's what he's communicated to Ishbosheth. I'm done with you. I'm meeting up with David. And here's his first conversation with David. Pick up in verse 12. This is Abner to David. Now, if you're David, what are you thinking right now? Like, man, really? Buddy, we fought in the wilderness. You know, I punked you in chapter 26 in front of everybody. You know, I was standing at your head and Saul's head. Like, this is an odd guy to move over, right? There's not a guy that you look on with more suspicion than Abner and go, you were Saul's most loyal man, and now you want to come help me establish my kingdom. You're a liar, you're a spy, you're something, but this is odd, okay? So David is like, okay, prove it, verse 13. Why would David request Michal from Abner? What's that saying? Who's Michal? First wife, who, what's her relationship? Saul's daughter, okay? And not very good. She's married to another dude right now, okay? So why would David be saying, okay, you want to restore the kingdom to me. If you're honest about this, I need Michal back as a wife. What's his motivation? Well, he's got other wives, and she's a chump, and we're going to find out their relationship ain't great. What else? Think politically. Why would David need Michal? Absolutely. So now he's got Saul's daughter in his line. Okay, the wife that was given to him by Saul is now his again. David was shamed publicly when she was given away to another person. So that was now he's claiming back what is rightfully his in the sense, and being honored when he was dishonored. He's putting her in a position to say, listen, I'm aligning myself with Saul. That's a political connection. So those of you that are still fans of Saul, see also Michal. She's mine. There's a connection. You don't have to hate me. You like her, okay? And then what would it also say for, why would this be a test for Abner? Abner would realize what this means, the significance politically of this, and to align himself. You guys with me? So for him to say, I'm going to take him take Michal away from her current husband, give her back to David. It's symbolic in a lot of ways. Okay, so this is, end of the day, it's a great test. Okay, so he says, great, put your money where your mouth is, go get my former wife. And Abner does it, okay? Let's see. It says, give me Michal, verse 14, who I was betrothed for 100 foreskins. Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband. So Ishbosheth's a part of this. Her husband went with her weeping as he went and followed her as far as Bahurim. And then they basically say, go back home. And basically David takes her back in 16, okay? Abner, watch what he does in verse 17. Read this. That's a pretty good speech, right? Who is Israel following at this point? Saul's dead. Ishbosheth is a puppet king that everybody realizes that. Who's the guy they trust? Abner. And he says, look, you know what was coming with David. You talked about him being king. Step up and do it. Make him king. Like, that's a pretty impressive speech from Abner. Do it now. Okay, so he's fighting for David. Abner also spoke in verse 19, the hearing of Benjamin. In addition to Abner, went and spoke to the hearing of David and Hebron and seemed good and wise in Israel to do in the house of Benjamin. Verse 20, Abner and 20 men came to David at Hebron. David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. So David is beginning to go, man, at first, I don't know, but you brought me Michal. You make this big, you know, emotional plea to all of Israel to come join me. David's beginning to soften and go, and I think this guy's legit. So he holds a big feast for him. They get together and have dinner. And then 21, this is Abner's last request of David.
And Abner said to David, I will rise and go, and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, and that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires.
So they have a meal, and he says, man, my next task is to go back, and I am bringing Israel with me. I've made the plea. I'm coming back to make them, you know, they put down their down payment, now they're going to pay and make it due. You are going to be king over Israel, and I'm the guy that's going to unite it, okay? He's shown with Michal in these speeches that he seems to have the right intent. We don't know for sure, but he sure seems to be on David's team at this point. What does David say, end of verse 21?
So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace.
So David's like, okay, go do it. Now, if you didn't trust Abner and you're David, like, what would you do? What are your options? Could you have him killed? You could. I mean, there's some things that you could do, right? Or at least not let him go, detain something. But he seems to trust him. Now, who's the guy do you think that's like, you know what? I am Abner's least. Who's the guy that hates Abner more than anybody at this point? Joab. See also verse 22, okay? Joab gets word that he didn't get invited to this dinner party, okay? Servants of David came to Joab and said, hey, David and the king had dinner, and he said, I'm sorry, or David and Abner had dinner, and he says, what? That ain't right. That's not good, and David sent him away in peace. So they had a good meal, they talked, they drank some wine. They're chummy now, and Joab's like, what you say? Like, they're what? Like, that is not okay with me. Verse 24, Joab now shows up on David's doorstep and says, what the heck? What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why then have you sent him away? Why is he already gone? You know, verse 25, that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to learn if you're going out and you're coming in, to find that all you're doing. That is a very valid, like, yeah, that absolutely could be what happened. David sees it one way. Joab sees it another. Okay, verse 26, keep going.
When Joab came out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it.
So how is Joab operating right now? They have this conversation, Joab tells him what he thinks, David doesn't respond, he doesn't get the answer he wants apparently, so what's he going to do? He's going to take justice into his own hands, and here's what he does, okay? 27, he's going to have a one-on-one conversation with Abner.
So when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the middle of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the belly so that he died on account of the blood. of Asahel, his brother.
So he slaughters him. Anybody notice where they are when this happens? What's that? Very public place. What city? Hebron. Okay. Rewind the tapes way back to Numbers. Why is Hebron such a significant city? Why would they have mentioned that city? There were six of them. What were they called? Cities of refuge. And what could you not do in a city of refuge? Kill someone. So Joab is dirty. Basically, Abner had the right to be in Hebron because he slaughtered one of Joab's brothers, even in war. To be in Hebron would have gotten him a get-out-of-jail-free card, right? Until the high priest dies, I'm safe. Now, if I'm outside of the city and you kill me, that's a whole other thing. Now, this is war. This isn't your typical Levitical whatever, but this is dirty upon dirty. So he goes around David's wishes, pulls Abner aside and says, I don't care what David thinks. This guy's dirty, and slaughters him and has a whole different... He paints to Abner a whole different motivation. Hey, let's come, let's have a conversation. They're one-on-one, and now it's right in the belly, okay? And it's over, okay? This is a bad deal. Now, how do you think this appears to David? How does this appear to the people who are following David? This is not good, right? You just had Joab conveniently murder Abner, the only guy that was a threat to your throne. So this is not what David needed to exalt himself up in the kingdom, okay? So the problem is David has no way to defend himself, right? This looks like a ploy, and if he's serious about liking Abner, it sure doesn't look that way. It's going to be pretty hard to talk yourself out of that, right? It seems like the real motivation for Joab was vengeance for his brother, but also I think he genuinely felt like, look, Abner's full of it, and I think he's lying to you, and I think he's coming to spy, so we're going to put him down, even though that's not what he wants to happen. Not what David wants to happen. That's the end result. Okay. 31. This is what David commands the people to do. Read that.
David said to Joab, to all the people who were with him, take your clothes and put on the sackcloth and mourn before Abner.
All right. So he's trying to be as public about this as he can and say, listen, this was not right. Verse 33. Should Abner die as a fool dies? No, we're going to honor him. This is not right. You'll notice in verse 35 and following, David is basically fasting, didn't eat bread the whole day. So he's grieved over this action. The people in verse 36 took note of the way that David was mourning. It pleased them just as everything the king did pleased all the people. So the people in all Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner the son of Ner to death. So David's actions, the way he responds to this, convinces the people, okay, this wasn't a murder, coup, whatever. You weren't trying to put down a threat. This was Joab acting in isolation, and the people understood that. So David still has the favor of the people, okay? And pretty significant verse, just as everything the king did pleased the people, like you've won the hearts of the people when they see you and go, man, absolutely, David, we trust you. Okay. Now, if you're David, what is your problem now? Right? With specifically who? Joab. He has acted outside of your wishes. He's a loose cannon right now. And I want you to notice 38 and 39. This is one of David's fatal flaws. Read 38 and 39. Okay, that's Joab and Abishai, the two remaining brothers, okay? May the Lord repay the evil doer according to his evil. So what does David recognize about the actions of these men, Joab and Abishai? Specifically, Joab. It's wrong. It's evil. But what does he do? Nothing. David does nothing. Now, this, remember, that's his nephew, right? This is family. Like, what do I do here? Like, do I have him killed? Do I stick him in a city of refuge for the rest of his life? Do I fire him from his job, which is what he's going to do here not too long from now? He's going to remove him from his place as commander, bring up another guy that Joab's obviously not fond of either because he lost his job. He's got a few flaws, but one of them is He's hesitant to act in times like this, and he doesn't know how to handle Joab, who's grasping for power, and he's kind of puffing out his chest. He doesn't correctly discipline Joab in this moment, and he should have. He knew what was right. He just failed to do it. Okay, so, and welcome to all of our lives at times, right? Knowing the difference between what's in our head and what we actually do. Sometimes there's a gap. David wrestled with the same thing. Okay, so, all right. So chapter 4, we've still got an issue with Ishbosheth. So let's pick up chapter 4, verse 1, and let's watch what happens here.
When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed.
Yeah, so that's bad. Abner's dead, you realize, oh, I'm the puppet, and I have no puppeteer. Uh-oh, my life's over, okay? So he basically takes off, and there's some guys that come after him. Verse 7, there's a couple guys that realize, maybe if we kill Ishbosheth, David will reward us. Okay, see also the same guy that thought he would get rewards for killing Saul. Verse 7, this is what they do.
When they came into the house as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of Arabah all night.
Okay, so they had come in, verse 6, to say that they were coming to get wheat in this area, and they basically, while he's laying on his bed taking a nap in the middle of the day, kill him while he's asleep. So dirty, okay? But they take his head, and they take his stuff, and they say, hey, let's bring it to David, because we're going to get, like, super props for this. Now, knowing David's history, what do you think is about to happen now? They're not going to get what they want, right? So they come to David and say, hey, look, behold, Saul's dead, and hey, good news, like, you know, woohoo, and Ishbosheth is dead. We killed him. Okay, here's David's response, verse 11. I'm sorry, pick up in, go ahead, 11, my bad.
How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?
So he basically says, man, you guys are idiots. I'm not, like, I didn't even reward a guy who came and told me about Saul's death. That was even less dirty than what you guys have done. Really? You think that you're going to get props for this? David commanded, verse 12, the young men, they killed him, cut off their hands and their feet, and hung them up beside the pool of Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the grave of Abner in Hebron. So those guys get put down. So again, David's having to deal with some stuff that externally does not look good, right? Joab takes Abner down. How's he going to respond? How are the people going to see that? Now the current king, Ishbosheth, is mysteriously murdered, and the guys come to David seeking a reward. How does David handle that? He says, absolutely not, kill those guys. So he's having to make some very public statements about how he feels about these things, okay? And what we're seeing is the people are watching very carefully as to how he responds, okay? Ishbosheth obviously shouldn't have been murdered. That wasn't David's heart, but that's what happened, and now he has to respond to that, okay? As a result, chapter 5. Okay, here's where it finally comes together for David. Okay, chapter 5, verse 1. Pick up there.
Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, behold, we are your bone and your flesh. Previously, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be a ruler over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord at Hebron, and they anointed David king over Israel.
All right, so now we get all the tribes from the north that have come down, and they say, hey, it's taken a little bit too long, but we're here. We recognize, by the way, previously that you, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in. What does that mean? Tell me what they're saying about David. What precedes his kingship?
His service,
his reputation, his faithfulness, okay? Character comes before position. And they're saying, David, we know you. We've seen you act over time. You were faithful to Saul. You're legit. You're not some Johnny-come-lately. We know who you are. Our bad. We shouldn't have followed Ishbosheth. We shouldn't have listened to Abner. We knew it was coming. We're here and we want to make a covenant with you. Okay, so verse 3, the elders of Israel came to the king. They make this covenant and they now anoint David king over Israel. Okay, verse 4, notice the timeline here. Pick up in 4 and 5.
David David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years.
Okay, so there's your chronological anchor that we've seen. Okay, all the kings over the United Monarchy, Saul, David, and Solomon, all 40 years. David's 30 years old when he gets put on the throne. Okay, this is before he unites everybody. Okay, keep going in five.
At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah.
Okay, so he rules over the south for 7.5 years before Israel from the north finally comes down and says, our bad. Okay, so 7.5 years, he has to wait longer to unite the kingdom. Okay, so when he has everything together, Israel and Judah, and he's the king over all of the land, how old is he? 37.5, okay? How old was he when God said, you're going to be king over Israel? Way back in 1 Samuel 16. At best 12. I mean, that is a long time to wait. I mean, we're talking 25 years, at least 20 if he was a little bit older. He got the kingship at 30 at least for half of it, but the full fulfillment didn't come until 37.5 years old, okay? So David has waited a long, long time for this to occur, okay? So keep that in mind. All right, now if we were to start, that would be really bad if I dropped that on the ground. Sorry, guys. We're gonna need to pay those late fees so we can buy another one. All right, and a wireless mic. So if this is 31 down here, okay, how are we seeing David's life trajectory go now? Up, right? Okay, so it's rising pretty quick. And if we were to kind of put it back on plane, he's, you know, if that's level, he's probably somewhere about right here in 2 Sam 5, right? We've seen some leading up to that. He's had to put down some coups, but his fame is rising and he is back on the rise, okay? This is going to be from 2 Sam 7 to 2 Sam, really 11. This is going to be the pinnacle of David's career, okay? This season in his life that we're about to read is Camelot. It is as good as it ever gets, ever, under any king in Israel, Solomon included, okay? They have maybe not as much land as Solomon is going to get because he's going to rule with, he's got some political savvy. But from chapter 7 all the way through chapter 11, we're going to see God bless David's socks off. It is amazing. Okay, so let's pick up there and just kind of begin to see this plateau of awesomeness that basically David lives on as a result of the way he is, who he is, his character, and that sort of thing. All right, so 33 years he's going to reign after this takes place. Okay, so 37.5 years old. And now David's going to come in and move the capital, okay? So this is the first time we've seen this. Chapter 5, verse 7, pick up there.
Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David.
Where is Zion? What city is Zion? Jerusalem, okay? Okay, the city of David. So when David begins to conquer this city, they're going to establish the city of David. That's the old city. When we go to Jerusalem, we're going to go to the city of David. That's the portion that David reigned. As it grew and more kings came and Jesus' day with Herod, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and they continue to build out Jerusalem, basically. And you get to see all that when we get there. But David's going to go capture the city. The problem is they don't have it right now. You guys remember the Jebusites, whatever ites that were in there beforehand? Israel does not have control over the city, so he's got to go fight for it. David realizes, if I'm going to unite these kingdoms, I can't be down south in Hebron. It's a bad spot. I need to get up to Jerusalem, which is more of a natural go-between between the north and the south. It's a much better place to rule from. It's fortified. It's protected. It's all the things that a great city should be. So David says, we're going to take it. Okay. So he basically does that. They punk these guys. They feel like, man, it's not defeatable. David comes in and defeats them. David became greater, verse 10, and greater, and the Lord of hosts was with him. This is just an amazing statement about David. Look at 11, 12, and 13, or 11 and 12. Read that.
Here among king of Tyre sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also carpenters and masons, who built David a house.
All right, so Hiram, king of Tyre, is the guy that's up north, current-day Lebanon, on the coast, but up north, like north of Dan, okay? They're way up there, and they are responding. This is the response that David gets from everyone around him. That is, friends, they realize, David, your day's here, and it's a huge day. Verse 12, this is probably one of the most significant statements about David's kingship.
And David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel.
Walk me through that. Why is that so significant?
That it was God's time. Like, it's finally been established and promised that he gave when he was a young boy and been fulfilled.
Yeah, how good does that feel to have waited and say, I didn't kill Saul. God, you put me on the throne when you were ready. Okay? What else? Why is David king?
To build Israel.
For the people's sake. I put you there, David, to take care of the people. So what's his role?
To shepherd.
To shepherd. You are a shepherd of my people. David, why did I put you in the wilderness, in the middle of nowhere for years, taking care of sheep and cleaning up poo and having a miserable job? Because it's the same thing. You're there to take care of the sheep. It's not always a glorious job, but somebody has to care for them. David, what's your job now? Same thing. Your job is to take care of the people. Not to exalt yourself, not to be the guy, but that's the role. You see why God did what he did with David? It's the same why he did what he did with Moses and everyone else before him. You're a shepherd. Your role is to take care of the people and to do what's right for them, okay? And that's what great leaders do. It's not about exalting me, it's about exalting them, and that's what David realizes. And the reason that he is such a phenomenal king is he is able to, for the most part, not let his kingship go to his head. He rules with a right heart, loves God, has certainly some character issues that we're gonna see, but he is a great, great guy, okay? So this Camelot is beginning here, obviously in chapter 5, but in 7 and following is where we're going to see the full extent of it, okay? We get a list of family members. Notice who we see at the end of verse 14. One of his sons that's named is Solomon, okay? So we're seeing the kings, the coming king, obviously named there. By the way, Solomon was not the natural choice for David's sons. He was not a firstborn. Not Absalom. Amnon was his firstborn. Absalom is there. We got a number of sons that should have been king before Solomon. Solomon's still yet to come, obviously, with the story that's yet future. But obviously, the coming king is there. All right, so the next king after David will be him. Okay. 17, the Philistines heard that David had anointed, that they had anointed David king over Israel. All the Philistines went up to seek out David. They heard of it and went down to the strongholds. Philistines came up in verse 18, and now they're going to go, they're going to do some battle. Okay. David inquired, verse 19, and said, God, do you want me to go up to the Philistines? And he said, yep, go take them. Kind of a cool picture that's mentioned here. Philistines came up, verse 22, once again and spread themselves out in the valley of Rephaim. David inquired of the Lord and said, do not go up directly. Circle around them and come at them in front of the balsam trees. 24, this is what God says to David about this battle that's about to ensue between him and the Philistines. Read that.
Be when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then you shall act promptly, for the Lord will have gone out before you to strike the army of the Philistines.
So God says, surround them, wait. When you hear marching in the tops of the balsam trees, you'll know that God has gone out before you. What is that a picture of? What is God saying? Yeah, it's almost the idea of God's going into battle and he's so big you're going to hear him at the top of the trees going into battle before you. So just the picture of God being on David's side, or David being on God's side, but God says, this is what I want, this is right, I'm going to fight your battles for you, wait for me, you'll hear me come, and then you follow me. Okay, so God is taking care of David. Okay, David did so just as the Lord commanded him. And they struck down the Philistines from Geba as far as Gerar. So they are winning battles against the Philistines here at this point in their career. So David is now having to deal with his enemies. And there's quite a few that he's got to go deal with, but he's taking them down. Okay. Now, chapter 6, This is fascinating to me. So David finally has the kingdom. God has given him Jerusalem. He's putting the Philistines down. Notice where he turns his attention in chapter 6. Read that.
David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal of Judah to bring up there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim.
What does David go get? The ark. Why does he want the ark? Yeah, that's the symbolic presence that we have of God's presence in the kingdom. So he wants it. You guys know how long it's been gone at this point? 100 years it's been sitting during Samuel's battle, Saul's reign. It's been gone this entire time. Saul never even thought about it when he was king, didn't care about it, and he says, I'm going to go get it. So David decides to go get the ark. So I love that his heart is, I'm going to go get the right things in the kingdom. I've established a place in the symbolic picture of God I'm bringing into the kingdom. Okay, so you guys remember the story when the ark was traveling back down from Beth Shemesh, the Philistines had taken it, and Judges, people came in and like, what do we do with it? And they said, send it to Abinadab's house, like get it out of here because it's killing people. And it says that like 50,000 people died, which was probably a misprint. And they want nothing to do with it. So it gets stuck in this dude's house. Saul reigns for 40 years, doesn't even think about the ark. David establishes his kingdom, wins some battles. First thing he does is says, go get me the ark. We're going to get it. Okay, now, David has got a little bit more, he probably slides a little bit, as you guys would imagine, to the emotional side, and maybe not always balancing. His tendency is to be too emotive and not enough truth. Okay, some of us kind of been the other way, like me, that are probably a little bit more truthful and not enough emotive. David's going to struggle with that. Okay, so he says, man, let's get the ark. This is a great day. Let's celebrate. Okay, verse 3, this is how he gets it. Read that.
And they carried the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill.
All right, so when you read that, what do you hear? Whoops, right? Should David have known better? Yeah, there's some law around there somewhere that tells you very clearly how you're to carry the ark. Okay, so he sticks it on a cart, which is how it got to Abinadab's house, right? That's how it came from the Philistines. They just sent it back up. So he sticks it on a cart. They carry it down. Verse 5, read that.
David and all the house of Israel were making merry before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzziah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it.
So you can see this, right? It's coming down from, by the way, chapter 6, verse 2, Baalei Judah is where it's coming from, which is Kiriath Yearim. That's one of the first cities we're going to visit in Israel. Beautiful place. Ladies, you're all going to want to get married there. It's absolutely gorgeous. They're bringing it down out of this wooded mountain area, and they're partying, right? They're playing lyres and cymbals, and they're having this huge party. There's this emotive response. They're all dancing. Problem is, they're not obeying the truth that they know. The ark should be being carried by Levites through poles, specifically the Kohathites, right, the specific family, and they're partying. And the problem is, this oxen that's carrying it upsets the cart, and it almost falls off. The ark almost falls off the cart. So Uzzah steps up to protect the ark from following. And what happens to this guy? Verse 7.
And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error. And he died there beside the ark.
Wow. So this guy, trying to do the right thing, steadies the ark so it doesn't fall off the cart. And what does God do? Kills him instantly because of his irreverence. You're like, man, really? What's the lesson in this for David? Because you're on something. What is God trying to communicate to David?
The ark's serious.
It's a holiness to it. David, are you above the law? No. Okay. You need to follow the law. You're king. Love your heart. You worship. That's fantastic. We're going to do things the right way. And you're not above the law. So, guy touches the ark. Uzzah, sorry. Great heart, but you're dead. Okay. David is interesting. His response, verse 8, became very angry because of Uzzah's, because the Lord's outburst of anger against Uzzah. And David didn't know what to do. So he sends the ark away to Obed-Edom, the Gittite, okay? Stays at his place for, it's like 3.5 months, something like that. Anybody see the date? I'm trying to remember where it is. 3 months, verse 11, okay? And David finally realizes, oh, idiot, I forgot to read Leviticus. And he does it right. 1 Chronicles 15 basically says, verse 13 here, it says, and it was so that when the bearers of the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, they sacrificed an ox and a fatling. David read the law, sent the Levites to go get it. They get it the correct way and now can bring it back into Jerusalem the way that God wanted it to be. Okay, we don't see that specifically mentioned here, but in 1 Chronicles 15, we see that David got it right. Now, 14, they're still laughing and dancing and a celebration because this is a good thing, but now he's taken an emotional response and truth and put them together, which is what God wants. So emotion's great. It's great when it's driven by truth.
Is the tabernacle still at Shiloh at this point?
It is. Okay, tabernacle's still at Shiloh.
Wouldn't that be where
there's some interesting debate about that. Let's wait, okay? But yes, tabernacle's still at Shiloh. He's bringing the ark back, and we're going to see in chapter 7 why he's bringing the ark back to specifically Jerusalem, okay? So David does this. They celebrate. Verse 19, the ark comes back in. He distributes to all the people and all of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread and one of the dates and one of the raisins to each of the people. Then he told the people, go, depart to your house. So he gives these people mandrakes. You guys remember the story of mandrakes with, he gives everybody Viagra and says, go back to your houses and celebrate. That's what David just did. Okay, he says, it's going to be a good night for everybody in Israel. Okay, so go party. We're going to, husbands and wives, go do the right, okay, so in context. But that's basically what he just did, all right? So they're celebrating, they're loving this interaction, and it's a good scene. Here's the last interaction that we see between David and his first wife, Michal, okay? Verse 20, pick up there.
And David returned to bless his household, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, how the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, his female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself.
Okay, now, just understanding this context, uncovering himself doesn't mean David uncovered himself. Uncovered himself means he's dancing probably in his long white bathrobe undergarment, okay? So none of his priestly garments on. He's got his white linen robe on that would have been very common, very undistinguished between anyone else around them, okay? Nudity in this society is frowned upon in a way that is even more significant. So that's not, I don't think, what this text is saying. He is looking very unkingly in this moment. And Michal, the daughter of the former king, married to the current king, says, kind of down her nose, really? This is how you're going to act? You're dancing with these commoners and looking like a commoner? So you kind of get an idea of the type of gal that Michal is. Like, she's the girl that needs $400 shoes, and like, oh boy, right? So that's Michal, okay? So David says to her, verse 21, read that.
It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will make merry before the Lord.
that's a punking, right? God chose me over your dad. Take that, so shut up. 22, that's what he said gently.
I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. But by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death.
Like, ouch, like God said, shut down, okay? You guys know that song Undignified, David Crowder Band? That's where the song comes from. I will be even more undignified than this. That's what David's basically saying. It's a great cry to say, this isn't about me. I will dance with the commoners. I am a commoner. We're going to celebrate God today. The attention is not on me. It's not about me. It's about God. So you guys seeing a picture of God or David's heart in the midst of this, of just why God loves this guy so much, why God would have put a man like this on the throne. Very normal, very unimpressive externally. He's not Fabio like Saul, but he's a guy that loves God. And that is what is so amazing about David. Okay, so there you go. All right. Camelot, you guys ready? Here's where it begins. He's got peace on one side with the Philistines. He's dealt with them a bit. He's going to go do some other battles on the other side of things. Chapter 7, we're going to see why David was bringing the ark back to Israel. Okay, 7 verse 1, pick up there. So what is David saying to Nathan?
Why do I have a better house than God?
Yeah, I've got a mansion and God's got a tent. Like something seems wrong about this. Where's David's heart? That's the right place, right? Now, did God tell him to go build me a temple? No. Then there was something about the mobility of the tabernacle that was good. And where would David have gotten this idea of a permanent house for a deity? Where have we seen that before? Yeah, Dagon, Philistine, right? So it's a little, like, maybe, okay? I tend to see this as positive. I've heard some others that view it maybe as negative. It's hard to say. I think David's heart's in the right spot. So he's saying, man, listen, God needs to be exalted. If I'm living in a mansion, God's house should probably look better than that. God's not just common. So David is trying as best he can, the best he knows, to exalt God. Nathan the prophet says what? Green light, dude, go for it. Your heart's right. And Nathan's going to be the guy in his life that's kind of the barometer of, yeah, that's a good idea, not a good idea. Okay, so he does that. And he basically says, man, I want to go build God a house. And God says, man, David, that's awesome. I like that. Okay, I'm a big fan of that. However, you're not going to build me a house. I'm going to build you a house. In fact, he basically tells David, you're a man of bloodshed. Okay, you got to go fight a lot of battles. You're not going to build a house. Solomon will, this physical house that you desire to build, but I'm going to build you a house that you're going to freak out about. This is God to David, okay? So God speaks to him. Pick up in end of verse 11, the Lord also declares that the Lord will make a house for you. When your days are complete, verse 12, when you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendants after you, who I will come forth from you. I'm sorry, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. Verse 13, he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Okay, so there's going to be a guy that comes after you. He's going to build my house, and from him, that's obviously Solomon, how long is that kingdom going to last? According to verse 13, forever. Okay, keep going in 14 and through 16.
Took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever.
13, forever, 16, forever, 16 again, forever. So what is God promising David? This isn't just you're king, and when you die, it's going to be like Saul, and we strip it from you and transfer it to someone else. God sees David's heart, obviously, in this, and he's known this for a long time. He says, David, because of your heart, your kingdom is going to be established forever. I'm going to take care of you. And that's what he promises. Not just Solomon, who's going to build me a house, but after you, your kingdom will endure.
Is 14 about Jesus?
I believe 14 is about Jesus. Okay? Who is the final Davidic king that sits on the throne of Judah? David. That is why Jesus had to come from... Did I say David? The final Davidic king that sits is Jesus. My bad. That is why Jesus had to come from the line of Judah. This is the Davidic covenant right here. You guys remember the covenants that we talked about in Scripture? Land, seed, and blessing with the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, the three aspects of this. The land is the Palestinian covenant that we saw in like Deuteronomy and the scope of the land. This is the seed. So we can trace David's lineage all the way back to Abraham, and we can trace forward from here Jesus' lineage all the way back to David. So God is saying to David, I'm going to make you king forever, and you're going to have a seed that ultimately is going to end with Jesus. Okay, and that is why Jesus' lineage is so important. This is the promise. Okay, so the Davidic king that will rule forever is ultimately going to be our Savior. Okay, this right here is the Davidic covenant, okay? That's an important one to remember, okay? So we've seen Abrahamic, okay, which is all three aspects, okay, land, seed, and blessing. The land portion is in Deuteronomy 30 with the Palestinian covenant, okay, and the extent of the land. This is the seed portion, okay? The last one we won't get to, it's in Jeremiah, which is the new covenant, which is basically the promise of blessing, okay? But those are the three branches of the Abrahamic covenant and where they get fulfilled in greater detail, if you will, okay? So this is God's promise to David saying, thank you for wanting me to build your house. You think that's great? I'm going to go ahead and one-up you, and I'm going to build you a house. So take that, David, okay? So God doesn't let him build it because he's a man of bloodshed, but he says to him, you're going to be the guy, okay? 18 and following is David's like, holy cow, wig out, God, you're awesome speech, okay? So he just exalts God as you would expect from David, tells him how awesome he is, and all the way through the end of the chapter, it's a, God, you get the glory.
In 15, he says, my steadfast love will not depart from him, and they took it from Saul. He took that love from Saul, or Saul?
He removed his presence or his spirit from him, his choice of Saul, and he says, I'm not going to remove my choice of you and my, yeah, because of Saul's actions toward the kingdom from him. I think that's the picture. So your kingdom will never get torn from your line.
Like Saul did.
Oh. Exactly. Yeah. Now it's going to get jacked in the kings when Solomon ultimately has a son named Rehoboam. Rehoboam splits the kingdom. So it's going to get really, really messed up. But there's always going to be a king that's going to be able to be traced all the way through. Okay. So he's still going to discipline kings that are knuckleheads. But that's the idea. Okay. So make sense? All right. You guys okay over there? Good.
That's part of the reason why when David sends him back with Bathsheba and he writes that psalm saying, Lord, don't take a spear with my hand.
Yep.
It seems to be the fear that
yep.
he would then, just like with Saul,
exactly.
you're not, your kingdom line is done.
That is the correct theological response to that. It's the sign of blessing and God's commitment to use me. So don't take your spirit from me. Don't take your hand of blessing off of me. Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right, chapter 8, okay? It's not just about Jesus. That's specifically about Solomon, but I think as you look at the forever aspect of it, it's talking about, man, the fulfillment of that forever is Jesus. So there certainly is a sense that 14 is about specifically Solomon. So if I misspoke there to make it all about Jesus, but it certainly...
Like he and himself didn't do wrong. But.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never looked at it like that. Possibly. I don't know. All right, chapter 8, okay? More battles, all right? Chapter 8 is all about all the people that David's got to fight, okay? So 8 verse 1, notice who he takes down. Philistines, okay? Verse 2, Moab. Verse 3, David defeated Habenezer, son of Rahab, king of Zobah, all these guys. 4 and following talks about all the stuff that David gets. Look at all the way to the end of verse 14. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. 15, David reigned over all of Israel, and David administered justice and righteousness for all his people. So who is David fighting these battles for? His people. And what is he ultimately doing? He's creating peace in his kingdom, okay? At this point in his life, David has basically put down all his enemies. He doesn't have any left, okay? Skip chapter 9. Chapter 10, we see more on battles. You guys remember Nahash, the guy that struck down the Jebusites? He finally dies. His son comes up to power. David decides, man, I'm going to do something nice to him. His son doesn't have the relationship with David. So for whatever reason, David now saw Nahash as a friend, not a foe, or was at least trying to make an olive branch offering. Now that Nahash is dead and his son, Nahon, I think is his name. Yeah, verse 2. He's trying to make things right with him. Nahon doesn't respond real well. So they end up going to battle and David puts them down as well, basically. Okay, so kind of to fast forward through the story, I want to concentrate on chapter 9 and what happens there. Okay, so David at this point in his life, he's established his kingdom. God is blessing him. He's punking everybody, all his enemies, and he has peace literally on every side. Okay? Other side of the Jordan, up now, up north, down south, everywhere, okay? And in chapter 9, David asks, I think, a pretty fascinating question given where he's at right now. Chapter 9, verse 1. What is David doing? What is he thinking about right now? That oath that he made with Jonathan. Jonathan's dead, but what did he promise him? I will do you guys right. So he asked the question, man, I've been fighting battles. I've been distracted with all these things. He's got a moment to breathe. He puts his feet on the coffee table and he says, man, who's left? Ishbosheth is dead. Is there anyone left in Jonathan's family that I can show kindness to, right? Because that's what he promised Jonathan, and he meant it when he said it, right? Okay, verse 2. Let's see the answer he gets.
There was a servant in the house of Saul. His name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, I am your servant.
Okay, so he gets this guy that knows Saul's house inside and out. Okay, he had been underneath Saul's line. He said, this guy will know. Okay, keep going, Evan. Okay, so what answer does Ziba give to David? There's a kid left, okay, he's a son, okay? What's his condition? He's handicapped, he's crippled, okay? Why would Ziba say that? What is he saying? Read between the lines. Yeah, there's a son left, yeah, okay, but he's crippled, he's lame, he's not really king material, you know, sitting at the table with Absalom and Amnon, and, you know, it's a very gentle rebuke to David saying, you probably shouldn't bother with it, okay? Notice David's response, verse 4.
The king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, and Lodabar.
And Lodabar, okay, which basically is like living in the Mojave. He's out in the middle of nowhere. Where he shouldn't be, okay? So he's a son of Jonathan. He should be living in or around Jerusalem, which would have been his tribal lands, okay? And he's not there. We do. How about you read that for us? How do we find out how this kid got crippled? Roll back there, okay? And we get the rest of the story, okay? Jeremy, read that for us. Chapter 4, verse 4 of 2 Samuel. So they're sitting at home, you got this kid, and they just get news that dad died and grandfather just died in battle, okay? So he's a five-year-old kid. What's the response then? What do you do when your dad and your grandfather, the king and the next king that would have been king in your line, are dead? Run. Why? Because the next king that's coming doesn't want your line around, okay? That would have been a very normative practice, okay? Who are my threats? Put them all down. Any threat to my kingdom anymore? Nope, that line is gone. I kill them all. That is non-godly, but very everyday normative behavior. That's what you did. And they realized that, so they ran. Keep going. Okay, so he has some accident and is now lame. He's handicapped from basically below the waist. Okay, he can't walk. Okay, what's his name? Mephibosheth, okay? Learn how to say that one, okay? There are 2 days that I like to teach residency, okay? Leviticus 16, when we talk about the Day of Atonement, and 2 Samuel 9. This is my favorite story in the entire Old Testament. It is the greatest picture, in my estimation, of grace that you will ever see, okay? New Testament included. Obviously, this is a picture of Christ and our Savior, but what you're about to see in these moments is it's just one of the most powerful pictures of what Jesus did for us, okay? So, kid who's lame, Mephibosheth, he has another name, Meribbaal, okay, that is named in Chronicles, which means from the mouth of shame, okay? Why would this kid be named from the mouth of shame? Whether he got this before or after his accident, I don't know, but why would that be fitting for a kid who's lame in both feet? How would he have been viewed in Israel? useless. You're lame. Okay? Which is exactly what Ziba is trying to communicate to David. He's useless. Don't bother with him. Okay? And he's in a place called Lodabar. Lodabar literally means barren or empty or nothing. Like it's there ain't nothing out there. Okay? He's not vacationing. He's hiding. Okay? So his goal in life at this point is I need the current king to never find me. Okay? I'm just trying to live out life. I'm being taken care of and served by a nurse because I can't take care of myself because I'm handicapped. I need someone to wait on me, and my greatest fear one day is that David finds out where I'm at, and he comes to my door and knocks on it. Okay? See also 2 Samuel 9, verse 5.
Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir to the son of Amiel at Lodabar, and Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage.
Now, if you're Mephibosheth and you get a knock at your door and they say, we're representatives of King David, come with us. The king wants to see you. What are you thinking? Like, after you change your underwear, you're thinking, I'm dead. This is my worst nightmare. So he comes in before David, crippled son that probably has to be brought before him. And what does he do in verse 6? He bows down. Okay, he is literally laying on his face in front of the king, okay? And he is hoping that whatever's going to be done, it's just going to be done quickly, okay? That there's going to be a sword on the back of his neck or whatever it is, okay? But he is thinking, man, I am living the last seconds of my life at this point, okay? What is David's response to him?
He said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table and always.
Now, what did he just promise Mephibosheth? Hey, this had to be shocking for him, right? He's expecting death, and what does David say? I'm going to bless you. Why? Because I made a promise to your dad that nobody else knows about. He's dead. Saul's dead. You don't deserve this. I don't owe anybody this. I am choosing to be gracious in this moment because that is the nature and the character of who I am. So don't fear, okay? What else does he promise him? You're going to get land, okay? You're going to get physical blessing as well. There's going to be a bounty that comes with you being restored. What else at the end of that?
Table.
You will sit at my table regularly. What does that mean?
It's a friendship.
More so. Who sits at the king's table? Sons and daughters. What is David saying? You're mine. It's the greatest picture. I get emotional every time I read this. It's the greatest picture in Scripture, I think, of adoption. God is saying, I'm taking you. David's saying, I'm taking you to be mine. I have every right to kill you. I have every right to put you down. But because of a promise that I made, I'm taking you as my son. And that's the story. And it's just a beautiful picture of grace, undeserved. Look at his response, verse 8. This is Mephibosheth speaking to David.
And he paid homage and said, what is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?
You'll see in Israel, dogs are regarded as, they're not thought of very highly. So he says, who am I? Why are you treating me this way? He's absolutely blown away by this response. He can't wrap his mind around that, okay? David doesn't even respond. He tells this to Ziba. Read verse 9.
Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, all that belongs to Saul and to all his house I have given to your masters for ransom. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce. Your master's grandson may have bread to eat.
So not only do you get your grandfather's land back, you're going to get Ziba, his old servant, and all of his family, and their job is to take care of the land for you. They're going to serve you so that you have food to eat, but you're going to eat with me regularly. Ziba said to the king, according to all that the king commands his servant, you shall do. Mephibosheth ate at the king's table as one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth, verse 12, had a son named Micah. In verse 13, Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem and he ate at the king's table regularly. And notice what doesn't change, end of verse 13.
Now he was lame in both his
feet. Right? He puts him there and there's a kind of a cool picture of sitting at a table. What does a table cover? Your feet, your legs. So as he sat at the table from the waist up, he looked like just like one of the other sons of the king. Okay, so really, really cool picture of, I think, just grace that is bestowed and given. Okay, now what I like most about Mephibosheth is the rest of the story. Okay, flip real quick to chapter 16. Okay, not to ruin what's going to happen, but as you guys know, David's son Absalom is going to rebel in the kingdom. Okay, so he's going to try to take David's throne for a number of reasons. Okay, and in chapter 16, we get a piece of the story that affects directly Ziba, who's Saul's servant who's taking care of Mephibosheth and Mephibosheth. Okay, 16:1, read that.
When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba the servant of Mephibosheth.
It's a hard one to say.
Met him with a couple of donkey saddles bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 branches of raisins, and 100 summer fruits.
So David, as a result of what's happened, Absalom's trying to take over. David says, you know what, I'm not going to fight my son. I'll leave. So David's leaving the kingdom. So Ziba meets him with all this stuff. And the king says to Ziba, verse 2, keep going.
And the king said to Ziba, why have you brought these? Ziba answered, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and the summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink.
So when the king's leaving town and the new king's on the throne, which is currently Absalom, and you come to the king and you give him all this stuff, what are you saying? You're choosing teams right now. Okay, what team is Ziba choosing? David, not Absalom. Okay, everyone else has basically at this point picked Absalom because he's in town and David's leaving, and all the people that are loyal to David are leaving with him. So Ziba says, here's a bunch of stuff to sustain you guys while you're gone. We're on your team, okay? That's the idea, okay? The king asked, now in verse 3, read that.
And where is your master's son?
Who's this? Who's the master's son? Mephibosheth. Where's Mephibosheth? Okay, fair question. He's basically saying, is he still with me? Is he on my side? Keep going.
He remains in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.
Ooh. What does Ziba just tell David? Mephibosheth's at home in Jerusalem with Absalom. Why? I'm going to be the next king. Good riddance, David. See you later. You know, take your donkeys and everything else with you. I'm enjoying all the stuff that you provided, but I get to be the next king, okay? This is the story that Ziba tells to David. Notice David's response, verse 4.
Then the king said to Ziba, behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours.
So what did David just do? All the land that I gave him, all the servants that I gave him, all the blessing that came with following me is now whose? Ziba's. Gives it all to him on the spot. Okay? So, fast forward, chapter 19. Coup gets put down. Okay? Absalom dies. So, sorry to ruin it all for you. We'll read it. It's fun. And David now comes marching back into the kingdom. Okay? And look who he meets. 19, verse 24.
He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety.
So tell me about Mephibosheth's condition. Now you guys got me doing it.
Can't take care of himself.
Okay. Can a guy with hands that work just fine trim your mustache and wash your clothes? Yeah. So what is he doing? What does this look like? This isn't, I can't take care of myself. He's mourning. He shows on the outside an external appearance of mourning, right? And David sees that, okay? He's unkept. He sounds distressed, right? He comes to meet David. How did that happen? That had to be an interesting scene, right? Watching Mephibosheth, I don't know, crawl on his belly. I don't know how lame he was, but he's lame in his feet, so he had to waddle or whatever it was to get to him. But he gets to David, okay? Keep going in 25.
To Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?
So he got the word from Ziba earlier because Mephibosheth wanted the kingdom. He wanted to be the next king. So that's why he didn't come with David, right? And David asked him, why didn't you come with me? 26.
He answered, my lord, O king, my servant, beseech me. For your servant said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself, and I may ride on it and go with the king. For your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you.
So what is Mephibosheth's answer? What does he tell David?
Ziba
lied to you, okay? I'm the real deal. I'm here for you. Everything's great. Now, if you're David, how do you know who's telling the truth? Is Ziba being honest or is Mephibosheth being honest? Why would Mephibosheth at this point in time say, oh, no, I was with you the whole time? Like, Absalom's dead, and I'm about to be dead next if I don't align myself with you. So watch what David does. This is brilliant and frustrating at the same time, okay? David's got a lot of wisdom about him, okay? So end of verse 27, Mephibosheth says, I've been with you from the beginning. You do what you feel is right, okay? 28, for all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my king, and you set your servant among those who ate at your table. So this is Mephibosheth's response, saying, you put me in a position that I did not deserve, a position that I love. What right do I have that I should complain any more to the king? So that's his final kind of plea to David, saying, man, how would I leave you? This is what I've done for you. But David has to weigh again. Is Ziba being honest or is Mephibosheth being honest? Okay, keep going in verse 29. So what's David's response? You get half of your stuff back. Half. Okay, why is David doing that? What is he trying to figure out? Is it just about the stuff that you get from following me that you want? Because if that's it and I gave you half, then what's his response going to be? Half? Like, what the heck? I should have all of it, right? Notice Mephibosheth's response in verse 30.
And Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come safely home.
Ooh, so who's being honest? Mephibosheth. He can have it all. I don't care about the stuff. I care about you, right? That is the picture of a gracious king giving grace and a servant who understands his condition, his need of grace, and his response to say, listen, man, the greatest thing about our salvation is not the stuff that we get. It's not heaven. It's that we get God. Okay, there's a whole chapter in a book by John Piper that talks about that, that the greatest thing about heaven is not all the accolades that come with it, which will certainly be there, but it's God. And he goes so far to say in the book is if you can imagine heaven and the greatest thing in your mind is not the continual worship and presence of God, then you've got a wrong understanding of what heaven is. The greatest thing that we get when we are saved is God. And that is the full reward. And Mephibosheth, in my estimation, has one of the best understandings in all of Scripture of that. I get you, I get a relationship with a king, and everything else, it doesn't matter. I could care less about the stuff, the land, the servants, their fodder, their icing. I already have the cake. Okay? So, again, one of my favorite pictures, and in my estimation, the greatest picture of grace in your entire Bible. So
in chapter 16, Ziba was lying.
Yeah. What did Ziba want? Stuff. He's ticked that David would have the audacity to give his family's land that he had served and worked for Saul to this crippled nobody. So Ziba was he looked down upon Mephibosheth. So he wanted his stuff. So, okay? So there you go. One of the neatest pictures you'll see. Okay? So there's a really cool song by, is it Leland? Is that the worship band? Mm-hmm. Yes, called At the King's Table or something like that. I just downloaded it. Anyway, and it's about Mephibosheth and his story. It's an old song that they redid, but go download it on iTunes. It's cool. Okay? So there you go. We're a little bit over. You guys enjoy your weekend. Have fun with PJ tomorrow in Romans, and I will see you guys next Thursday. All right? Peace.